Shinshu Roberts. I'm a teacher at Ocean Gate Zen Center, which is on 41st Avenue in Capitola, down south, Santa Cruz. I trained at San Francisco Zen Center for 17 years. My teacher is Sojin Mel Weitzman, who's the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center, and for a short while he was abbot at San Francisco Zen Center. So this morning I want to talk about case 55 of a Blue Cliff Record, which is Dao Wu's condolence call. Sometimes it's called I Won't Say. So let me read the case to you. Dao Wu and Jian Yan, his student, went to a house to make a condolence call. Yan hit the coffin 3 times, so he went alive or dead on top of the coffin. Dao Wu said, I won't say alive and I won't say dead. Yan said, well, why won't you say? And Wu said, I won't say. His teacher said, I won't say. So the service is over. They're on their way back to the monastery. And Yan, he brings it up again. And he says, tell me right away, teacher, and if you don't tell me, I'm going to hit you. And Dao Wu says, well, you can hit me, but I won't say. And so Yuan then hit him. Not advisable thing to do, by the way, is to hit your teacher. So they go back to the monastery, and Dao Wu sends Yuan away because he says, you know, you're going to get in trouble with the head of the monastery for having hit me, so I think you should leave. So he leaves. Sometime later, we don't know when, Dao Wu dies. So there are a couple of different versions of the story going from this point, but this is the version that I want to talk about today. So Dogen tells this story in the this version in the text that he wrote on the monastic regulations. So Chen Yan, Yuan goes on, and sometime later he's in a small temple and there's a carpenter working in the temple. And the carpenter chants out loud, he says, to those who would attain salvation as monks, he appears as a monk to expound the Dharma for them. And so the phrase is, and this is from the Lotus Sutra, chapter 25, which is about Avalokiteshvara. Do you know who Avalokiteshvara is? He's the Bodhisattva of compassion. So there's Avalokiteshvara. In Chinese, it's Kuan Yin. In Japanese, it's Kanon. So sometimes Chenrezig in Tibetan Buddhism. So Avalokiteshvara is usually a male figure. Chenrezig is usually male. Kuan Yin and Kanon are usually female figures. So Avalokiteshvara means here's the prize of the world. Right? Responds to the prize of the world. So this chapter is from chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra, which is a very famous chapter. So this is a sentence from the chapter. The whole chapter is about Avalokiteshvara and how wonderful, or Kanon, how great this bodhisattva is saving the world in any guise that's appropriate. So, okay, Yuan's there with the carpenter, and he hears the carpenter say, to those who would attain salvation as monks, he appears as a monk to expound the Dharma for them. And then suddenly, Yan was greatly enlightened, and he said, at that time, I was wrongly suspicious of my late teacher, Dao Wu. What had happened, I won't say, I won't say. How was I to know that his affair isn't words or phrases? Okay, so what is this koan about? So here we've got a student and a teacher, and they go to make a condolence call. So Yuan hits the coffin, says to his teacher, he says, alive or dead. His teacher, Dao Wu, says, I won't say, I won't say. So what is that moment of birth and death? What is it that we talk about as birth and death? What is alive and what is dead? So if we talk about, let's say, birth and death, When were you born? When do you die? So to say that something is alive or something is dead, from one perspective, well, we could say yes, at a certain point, a person is alive. And usually when we recognize that, although we kind of argue about it in our culture, we say, well, the person is fully alive when they're born. But then we talk about abortion, and then we get into talking about, well, exactly when is that moment that we say alive, right? There's a lot of dispute about that. And then we talk about death. When is that moment that we call death? Remember the little girl who died from the surgery and she's still alive on machines? Is she alive or dead? It's a big question. Big moral question. Is she alive or dead? So that's kind of talking about birth and death from a relative point of view. From this point of view where we can conceptually say this or that. But even in that realm, it's difficult to say this or that, alive or dead. From the realm of non-duality, what is to say one is alive or dead? What is it to say that? We can't say. Everything is completely interpenetrating and completely interconnected. So from that point of view, is there birth and death? From that point of view, everything is part of this vast process, if you will. Dogen talks about continuous practice. All beings are engaged in the continuous practice of the world making the world. So we are the world making the world. My watch is the world making the world. The trees are the world making the world. Your Zafu is the world making the world. The sun is the world making the world. Everything is completely present in this moment, right now. So how can you say alive or dead? How can the teacher say alive or dead? But the student's like, alive or dead? I want to know, is it alive or dead? He's asking that question, the student is, because he thinks somehow the teacher is going to be able to tell him alive or dead. And if he tells him one way or the other, then somehow that's going to be meaningful to him. So Dawu says, I won't say. Dawu says, I can't say alive or dead. So we can't say that something is this or that, but we want to say it's this or that. Somehow it makes us feel better. We think, oh, if I can just like pin it down, I won't have to be afraid, or I won't have to be worried, or I'll have some kind of closure in this moment. I can say, alive, dead. So we want to do this. But the reality is that what can we say is alive or dead? Are you the person you were when you were 5 years old? Is that person alive or dead? Is this moment, as soon as it passes, alive or dead? Is your past time in practice, the time of delusion, alive or dead? We want to say dead. Delusion, dead. I'm past that. And yet, it's here. When you do something that's enlightened, because we all do things that are enlightened, when you make a spontaneous, generous act, that's an enlightened response. Where does your delusion go? Is it dead? And when you do something stupid, where does your enlightenment go? Is it dead? Is it alive? So maybe we can't say. Maybe our teacher won't say if it's alive or dead. So that's part of, I think, what this is about. In practice, Dogen talks about, in Uji, being time, in the Shobogenzo, which means true Dharma eye, Dogen says, we think that practice is sequential, right? We think, well, I did this, I did this, I did this. If I do so many retreats, this is going to happen. If I do so many shishins or sit so many periods of zazen, or if I walk the right way, or my robes look good, or whatever it might be, right? Whatever story we have about the nature of what it is to practice. So Dogen says, so it is not the time climbing the mountain or crossing the river swallow up the time of the splendid vermilion palace. Does not that time spit out? That time? This time? So the mountain climbing the mountain. Sometimes, you know, we talk about practice as a metaphor. Well, I climbed this mountain. I came to Jokoji. I climbed that mountain. And then I crossed this river. I did a practice period at Tassajara. I crossed this river. So I've left my delusion behind. But he's saying, actually, those, and then we say we reach the Vermilion Palace, which, by the way, is a kind of erroneous conception. We all walk around with ideas about what enlightenment will be. And usually it's something like, I'm never going to have any problems, right? If I'm enlightened, everybody's going to like me because, well, I'm never going to do anything wrong. This sort of sense of certainty, right, about enlightenment. But enlightenment is it alive or dead? I can't say. Tao Wu won't say. He won't say to us, alive or dead. That time of alive and dead is completely present in this moment of practice. That time of alive and dead is that time of crossing the mountain, climbing the mountain, crossing the river. Stogen says, does not that time that we want to say is something past or something future, is not that time right now in the present moment. Because this present moment isn't missing anything. Alive and dead are right now in this moment. So we don't have to call it anything. All we have to do is be completely responsive. That's hard. So at the beginning, he says, he goes to make a condolence call. So imagine one of your relatives has just died. You're in your house. So the priest comes with his student to do a service, to do a memorial service. And suddenly the student goes, on your brother's coffin, is it alive or dead? Well, that's not very skillful. I think that would be very painful. It could be very painful that it happened to me. I'd say, well, what is this about? So this is a very ambitious student who doesn't really have any sense of what's going on in the situation. He doesn't have any empathy for what's happening. He's just thinking, I have to get enlightened. Oh, here's an opportunity. There's a dead body here. Let me bang on the coffin and say, alive or dead. So Tao Wu is actually quite nice to him. Tao Wu doesn't turn around and say to him, Sonny, shut up and sit down. You're being rude. Instead, he just says, I won't say. He didn't hit him 30 times. Sometimes in Zen stories, you know, there's a story where the teacher says, well, show me emptiness, and the student goes like this. And then he grabs him by his nose and pulls his nose, and the student goes, ouch, that hurts. He says, well, that's non-duality. That's being in the present moment. That's living your life right now where it is. Ouch, that hurts. So Tao Wu is very nice to him. He doesn't hit him or anything like that. He just says, I won't say. So Yuan doesn't give it up, right? They leave the house. They're walking back to the monastery. And Yuan's like, come on. I know you're holding back on me. You're the teacher, right? Teacher knows all the answers. You can tell me something that's going to enable me to have some great awakening experience. Isn't that how we'd like it to be? We'd like the teacher to go, tap, ooh, I've got it now. But it's not so easy, right? Because we have to understand it ourselves. Because we have to live the experience. There's that Zen expression about the finger pointing to the moon. So the teacher is the finger pointing at the moon. The moon is realization. Well, the finger is realization too. But we can't get caught with the finger or the moon. Somehow we have to find it right here in our own lives. So essentially Tao Wu gives him the answer, right? He says, I won't say, because he can't say. If he says it's alive, that's wrong. If he says dead, that's wrong. It's not alive, it's not dead. It's just this moment. Now, in this moment. So Dao Wu essentially gives him the answer to his question, but he can't see it. He can't understand it. So the only way that we can understand our practice is to actually live our practice right now in this moment. So we're sitting zazen, we say to ourselves, oh, this is great zazen. Or we say to ourselves, oh, this is bad zazen. I'm thinking, my legs hurt. But this is just what it is in this moment. This is your life right now in this moment. Whatever's happening in this moment, delusion, realization, life, death, this moment, fully experiencing it. And in that moment, whatever you label that moment, it's still just reality arising in this moment. Whether you call it alive or dead or a blunder or a mistake, or you say, oh, this is good or this is bad, it's still just what it is in this moment. So can we actually ground ourselves in our life as we're experiencing it? Dogen says when you fall down, you use the ground to get up off the ground. When we fall down, we have to push up against the ground to stand up. This ground is reality itself. We don't push against something called emptiness when we get up. We push against this, just this, something beyond this or that. Our life, right, helps us to stand up. That's the world making the world. Everything is completely present in that moment. It's not alive, it's not dead. It's just this. So we don't want to get caught by this. We don't want to get caught by these labels. We don't want to get caught by trying to reify things, by trying to make things a certain way. We don't want to get caught by saying something like, well, it should always be this way. It should always be that way. I should be this. I should be that. This person should be this. This person should be that. It's not about that. It's somehow about aligning ourselves with the totality of our experience. Dogen says, to array the self is to make the world. This is an uji. Arraying the self is not talking about the small self. Arraying a self is saying, when we are in accord with all of reality, just as it is, with our situation, just as it is, when we're in accord with that, the world comes forward to meet us. In Genja Koan, he says, to carry the self forward is delusion. So the small self in this case, when we try to force an issue, when we're like Yuan and we're like going, teacher, tell me, tell me, tell me, right? If you don't tell me, I'm going to hit you. So this way that we kind of bang on the door, you know, I'm carrying myself forward. This is the small self. I want this, I want this, I want this. So this give it to me, give it to me. Or don't give it to me. I don't want it. That's another thing, right? We want it, we don't want it. We want to reify our sense of self. This is a definition in the Four Noble Truths of what is the cause of suffering. To push things away because we don't want it, to try to get something that we want, clinging to things, and this, what's called re-becoming, which is this constant need to define to ourselves who we are. Not just, you know, we define ourselves in positive ways, but I think as Americans, particularly my experiences, we tend to define ourselves in negative ways. I'm not good enough, I'm not this, I'm not that. So let that all go. Try to let that all go and presence ourselves for what's actually happening. What is happening with that other person? It's not just about me getting my way, but what's happening with that other person? To carry the self forward is delusion, to allow myriad things to come forth is realization. Myriad things coming forth is the environment. We talk about taking care of the environment. That's allowing myriad things to come forth. So when, you know, historically when the people from the East Coast who were settling the West went out and they slaughtered all the buffalo just because they could, take home those trophies, whatever. Now we've got people who are going out and hunting in Africa and killing all the lions because they want to take lion head home and put it on their wall. So this is this way where, or if we use too much water... we insist on washing our dishes in a way that uses too much water, or we have to have a green lawn in the front of our house. We're not just about, this isn't just about saying, well, that other guy is doing this thing. It's a question of what are we up to? You know, what are we doing? Is there something that I could do that was more from an environmental point of view, but relationally as a point of view? What's it like for the other person? I'm talking to somebody that I don't like. So when we talk to people we don't like, we say, I don't like this person in our heads. Oh, look, they did that again. Oh, look, they're doing that thing again, right? Yeah, I don't like the way they hold their face. I don't like the way they wear their clothes. I don't like those shoes. You know, this way that we make up these stories about people instead of actually presencing ourselves for what that person, who that person is in this moment right in front of us. Instead of, like, talking to ourselves about how we don't like this person. They always do this, they always do that. Or I always do this, or I always do that. This way in which we can find compassion for each other, actually see each other. So Dao Wu sees his student. Dao Wu sees that his student is desperately trying to figure out what is the nature of reality. This student, in a very unskillful way, is trying to follow the path, is trying to follow Buddha's way. So Dao Wu is kind to him. Dao Wu doesn't say, oh, I don't like your style, get out of here. Even when Dao Wu says to him, you should leave, he's saying it to him because he doesn't want him to get in trouble. He's saying to him because I think, you know, you kind of maybe went to, in this case, he's drawing boundaries. So this brings up another topic, which I'll just go ahead and talk about a little bit. So in this way that we incorporate ourselves, presence ourselves, in cooperation, interdependence, interpenetration with all being, it does not mean that we get run over. It does not mean that we can't set boundaries. What it does mean is that the way that we do it is compassionate, it's skillful. It doesn't have to be this push away. So Dao Wu says, you know, hitting me was not a good idea. I think you're going to get in a lot of trouble and you should probably leave. So he leaves, okay? So time goes by, and he doesn't forget his interaction with Dao Wu. It wasn't satisfying to him. So at first, it probably wasn't satisfying to him in a very kind of like me kind of way. I didn't get what I wanted. But there was something about it, because he's a sincere practitioner. There's something about it where he says, well, something was like not right there. Something was like, that didn't work, you know? How do I work with this? So that's a koan, right? Koans aren't just stories that we read in the Blue Cliff Record or the Mumon Kan or the Shoyoroku stories. Or these stories are about us. They're about us. So you have experiences in your life where they keep coming back. Often when an experience keeps coming back, we say, I don't want it. So we say, well, that's their fault. You know, when I was at San Francisco Zen Center, people would come and they'd come to the Zen Center and they'd go, oh, everybody here is so wonderful because everybody was enlightened. You know, everybody was like perfect. And then they'd start living there and they'd realize, oh, this person leaves the milk in the, you know, leaves the milk out on the counter in the communal kitchen. And this person clears their throat during Zazen and they move around and all of a sudden things are not so nice anymore. And then some people, that's when they leave. But that's when we should stay. Because that's when the koan's up for us. That's when the, what is this? What is this? What's going on? We shouldn't stay in an unwholesome or immoral situation. But most of the time, what we're experiencing is we're seeing ourselves in some way. And we don't want that. We can't be with that. So we say it's the other guy, it's their fault. So somewhere in this, Yuan didn't feel good about it. It kept coming up for him like a koan. What is it? What is this? Is it alive or dead? Is it alive or dead? So somehow, and Dao Wu's dying is unfortunate because he didn't get to do it with Dao Wu, but it didn't leave him, which means, is Dao Wu alive or dead? in this moment. Obviously, he's not dead. The teaching is still going on and going on. It's in Yuan, right? He's like, what is this? What is this? So he keeps coming back and keeps coming back. And eventually, here he is, and he has this experience in this temple. And he hears this recitation from chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra. And in this recitation of the Lotus Sutra, there are many scenarios given. So in this particular, here's a copy of the Lotus Sutra. So in this sutra, the Bodhisattva Infinite Thought asked Shakyamuni Buddha, he says, well, what is the character? What is it about Avalokiteshvara that makes him so skillful about that Bodhisattva? And essentially, the Buddha at that point, he starts to talk about how Avalokiteshvara appears in whatever guise is necessary for us to wake up, for us to have our suffering alleviated. So he says in this particular paragraph, he says that a person may appear as a Brahmin. Avalokiteshvara may be a tribal leader, a Hindu god, a warrior, a king, an elder, a citizen, a minister, a monk, which is what happened in this case, a youth, a maiden, a god, a dragon, or other mythical beings, a human or a non-human. Now, most of those examples are not really so applicable for us. But interestingly, at that time, when the sutra was written, to be, say, a woman who would bring the Dharma, well, sorry, that doesn't happen. To be a youth, don't we do this with kids? Oh, kids, what do they know? So whoever it is that we may be dismissive of, right? Whatever thing or person or anything that we can name that we may be dismissive of, our enemies. You know, in Tibetan Buddhism, they say, oh, be grateful for your enemy, because that's where we feel resistance. That's where we have this opportunity to wake up to our problems are what wake us up to what we need to work on. So to be grateful to our enemies. So in this case, Avalokiteshvara essentially appears in whatever guise is necessary in order to help us wake up, in order to alleviate our suffering. So when Yuan hears this, to those who would attain salvation as monks, he appears as a monk to expound the Dharma for them. He suddenly realizes that his teacher is Avalokiteshvara. He realizes he's able to drop the self at that moment, to drop his own idea about what was going on at that moment, and have this realization about this interconnected life, to have this realization that there isn't alive or dead. So he drops his intellectual understanding. Up to this point, when he was trying to quiz Dawu, it was an intellectual inquiry. It felt very emotional to him, I'm sure, because he hit Dawu. So obviously, there was a lot of frustration that came out of that. But he essentially had this intellectual inquiry about alive or dead. He was talking about emptiness, right? The doctrine of emptiness. We know from the way he acted at the funeral that he did not feel deep empathy and compassion for the people who were present. We also know that he didn't see Daowu's empathy and compassion for him as a student. He didn't see what Daowu was doing. So it was a very selfish act on his part. Doesn't mean he's bad, but it means that he was caught in that moment about having a preconceived idea about what it was that he wanted out of that situation. Avalokiteshvara has no preconceived idea. Avalokiteshvara is not out there. Our heart, our minds, our skillful means is embodied when we are completely able to respond to a situation in an appropriate way. And as I said earlier, you know, you probably do this all the time, but you don't credit it as enlightened behavior because it's not special enough. So whenever you do anything that's generous, especially when you don't even think about it, and we do this kind of stuff all the time, we're driving our car, we let somebody in front of us, and we don't even think about it. Or maybe we do think about it, and we think about it like, boy, I'd like to kill that guy in front of me for pulling in front of me. So there's that enemy who's the friend, who's the Dharma teacher for you, which is patience, patience please, a little generosity here. There's a lot of times we do a lot of generous, very skillful things, we don't even think about it. That's enlightened behavior. Because where else would enlightened behavior be? It's like the delusion. Where is it? Where is enlightened behavior? Where does it happen? Some special Buddha field somewhere, like in the Vimalakirti Sutra, where people get enlightened by smelling roses or something like that? Some special Buddha field that's not here on earth? Is that where enlightenment happens? Does enlightenment only happen in a Zendo? So think about it. You know, where is enlightenment? Where is it enacted? Well, it's enacted in your everyday lives. Dogen talks about, in this fascicle called Mystical Powers, he talks about our everyday activities are mystical power. Our everyday activities is the mystical power of the Dharma. So Yuan comes to realize this when he hears this phrase from the Lotus Sutra. In the Lotus Sutra, the actual phrase is, to those who must be saved in the body of a bhikshu, bhikshuni, upasaka, upasakya, he appears as a bhikshu, a bhikshuni, upasaka, upasika, and preaches them the law. So bhikshus are male monks, bhikshunis are female nuns or monks. Upasaka would be like a lay practitioner, and upasika would be a woman who's a lay practitioner. So he's saying that in this, he's given a whole list of various people, but this is the particular sentence in the Lotus Sutra that Yuan was awakened by. So Yuan realized at that moment that the I won't say was this deep, compassionate, inclusive, skillful moment that essentially was tailored for him, right? Because Avalokiteshvara, our compassion arises in specific situations, not in some kind of general globalized way. We think to ourselves, oh, compassion, I'm going to go to save people from Ebola. That's compassion. And it is a very, very, very compassionate act. But that's not where you are right now. Where you are right now is Sunday morning at Chikoji. So what's a compassionate act here? Well, I don't know. But they're everywhere, right? We have a compassionate act. Oh, you're sitting here listening to me. That's a very compassionate act. Thank you very much. So this way that we engage with our lives, and I think it's really important to credit ourselves, not in some kind of way of like, aren't I special and wonderful and great, but in this way of recognizing that we engage in compassion all the time, and that our engagement happens right in this moment, not someplace else. Maybe I'll stop there. I have a few more things from Dogen, but I think maybe I'll just stop there because I want to see if you guys have any questions or comments. So do you have any comments, questions? Elephants and dragons, bring me your questions.
Thank you for the talk.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Is it alive or dead?
I don't know.
You don't know. Yes, sir.
In your sutra book, page 3.
Oh, wait. Oh. He's going to ask a question.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Well, my thoughts were that the story sounds more about impatience than it does about alive or dead. Uh-huh. And the student's impatience.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was his impatience to resolve some confusion that he had.
Yeah.
But that also, in my own experience, impatience comes up around that, you know, resolving some kind of confusion, but also about improving my conditions.
Yeah.
If something hurts or, having a conflict with a friend or something like that, sometimes impatience can manifest as also trying to fix it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to fix it right now, you know.
Yeah.
Or if my body hurts or something, like, okay, well, let's get that under control, you know. But the thing is that, you know, it's kind of this pragmatic quality that I, you know, many people have. It's pragmatic, well, there's a problem, let's fix it, you know, let's get to it, you know. If there's an intellectual misunderstanding, let's resolve it, you know.
Well, I think, you know, it's really hard to, that, you know, Shantideva, who's a Tibet, was a monk like in the 8th century. He has this very famous text, and he talks about impatience. And impatience is often comes out as kind of anger or frustration. Usually, when we are feeling impatient about something, we say we want to fix it. There's this way in which we are very uncomfortable, which is what you're expressing. You're saying, this hurts. You know, so I physically might feel in pain, or I might feel like I want to resolve something right now, or I want to fix something. So it's really hard to listen and be present for something because you want to fix it. I'm kind of a fixer person myself, right? So it's like I have to like go, okay, we don't need to fix it. It's okay right now. It's all right. Just to be with that, you know. I think that's the thing about Zazen. Zazen is even if we want to fix it, we can't go anywhere. So we have a little bit of movement. We can like, okay, my leg's asleep. I'm going to move right now. But basically in Zazen, one of the things we're learning is patience, is to really just be with what's happening and let it kind of be there for us.
Like, question is this choice between passivity and patience, because on the other end of the spectrum we might convince ourselves that everything is fine the way it is, and why can't we just be zen about it and just accept it, and that's also
so that's a discernment process, and we find that out because we pay attention to what's going on, we pay attention to who we are as a person, and sometimes we don't know, right? And so we pay attention to what happens when we do things. And we realize, oh, this is not a time when I should be passive. We talk to our teachers, right? We go to Dokusan with our teachers. We talk to our friends who say, gee, is this a time that I should be passive? And they might say, well, you know, I don't know your name. And they'd say, you know, well, you tend to be a little passive, so maybe you need to do some work here. So there's this way in which it really is dependent upon the situation. Some situations require us to act. Some situations require us to be not passive, right? But I think present. We are always required to be present. Sometimes patience is what's required, just listening, just abiding, just being with. But I will say that abiding and being with and patience should always be the first step. And then out of that, we ascertain or can discern whether or not we need to act and how what we need to do. Does that make sense? So I say that's number one. Then number two. Sometimes we do the acting part before we've had a chance to really presence ourselves for what's going on. Because we just can't stand it. Any other thoughts here? Yes, sir.
We don't talk about boundaries much in sand, and it's something you mentioned.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how do you see the boundaries fit into sand? We're always talking about emptiness, and we never talk about our boundaries. Well,
boundaries are really important. And so sometimes, I think in Zen we talk a lot about we say, well, things just as they are would be an expression that we can understand to mean that we just have to go along with whatever's happening. But things just as they are doesn't mean that. Things just as they are means that we're willing to actually presence ourselves for our lives. At that point, action is going to be required. Actually, we're never, I don't think we're ever really passive in our lives. Because even passivity itself is an action. Even the lack of action is an action. So setting boundaries is, there are really times that it's very clear that, say, somebody is doing something that is completely inappropriate. It's inappropriate for someone to sexually abuse somebody else, right? There's a time that needs to have a boundary. You need to say, no, this is not okay. No, it's not okay to hit your children. No, it's not okay to slug your wife in an elevator and then drag around. You know, no, it's not okay to scream at people or whatever that might be. But the question then is, how do we skillfully respond to that? And one of the ways that we can enter into that question is to cultivate a kind of patience and willingness to not have a knee-jerk response ourselves, right? A willingness to have a kind of generosity, but not what Trungpa Rinpoche used to call idiot compassion. Idiot compassion is like, oh, whatever, I shouldn't do anything. So this practice is not about not doing anything. This practice is about presencing yourself in a way that allows you to suss out what's going on in a situation so that you can respond appropriately to what's happening. And sometimes that might mean setting boundaries. Sometimes that might mean letting some space happen. So in this case, Dao Wu did not set a boundary when Yuan hit the coffin, which I think would have been a really kind of inappropriate thing to do. But yet after Yuan hits him, he does set a boundary. He doesn't banish him in the sense of saying, you know, you're really a bad person. He just says, you know, I think that at this point you should leave because I don't want you to get in trouble. And this is really going to be disruptive to the community. So in that way, he did. He set a boundary, right? But it's really dependent upon the situation and what's appropriate. And so what we're trying to do is figure out a way to calm ourselves down, to find equanimity, to find stability of mind, so that when we make those decisions, the decisions we're making are the ones that are most skillful. Does that make sense?
Yeah.